This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joseph Cohen from Queens College in the City University of New York. For more, visit theannexpodcast.com. 2017 continues to be the year of airing out dirty laundry, you know, sexual harassment. Matt Lauer this morning, which I don't want to talk
about. Before you get any further, I feel bad about saying like, Franken, it's, you know, that's totally just like awkwardness. And then like right after we taped, something else came out. It was like a second.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead. This is the problem of a 1 week lead time.
Yeah. Keep in mind, this is Wednesday, November 29th.
So everything we say will, you know, because we're now on, you know, since we now have a scandal every 45 minutes.
You know? Yeah, it's true. But anyhow, I don't want to, first of all, this is going to become the Harvey Weinstein show if we keep up like this. But in any case, this is the year there's dirty laundry coming out, also with research misconduct. And this morning, and we are recording on Wednesday, November 29th, I read this article in Ars Technica about trouble again in psychology. Did you guys read this?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
French psychologist Nicolas, I guess it's Gauguin, from the University of South Brittany. And this guy has over 330 papers listed on ResearchGate. I couldn't look up the details because his website crashed this morning. Yeah. But suffice to say, this gentleman is extremely well published. And the kind of work he does are experiments that demonstrate a really conventional view of gender roles. The writer of the article, Kathleen O'Grady, characterized it as Mars versus Venus gender studies,
yeah,
which I thought was awesome. But like, did you hear some of his hot takes on gender?
Just like stuff that were almost like tailor made to like get traffic from Cosmo or, you know. It's all stuff totally. Like, you know, how sexy are high heels and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Like clickbait research. Among his blockbuster findings, men prefer women in red dresses. Men like high heels. Men are more likely to help women when they wear their hair down as opposed to a ponytail.
Or a bun.
And, you know, I could just.
Or a bun. We also ignore women.
Or a bun,
buns.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Let's be precise.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, measurement matters even when you're making it up.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? Like, I could just imagine someone like this. Like, I'm making a mental note not to do a French accent, but I could just imagine this guy saying, like,
before we started taping, it was 100% Pepe Le Pew.
No, but first of all, in Canadian culture, mocking a French accent is
okay.
Is
see,
very
but taboo. I'm an American, so I can say ZIRB. They require me.
Well, but I could just hear this guy thinking, like, this will drive the feminists wild. But hey. Yeah. It's science.
Yeah.
But like, turns out it's not science. Two other researchers, James Heathers and Nick Brown, caught some oddities in the reported stats, and they were able to reverse engineer his data. And they figured it out just by noticing odd roundings. Like there were a lot of variables that had odd roundings at the second decimal place. And clearly these researchers were very sharp, and they picked up on it, and they reconstructed the data. And it turns out like the probability of getting those findings was extremely small.
So what I don't get about this is, to me, the worst part of doing research is getting something through peer review and dealing with the fucking R&Rs and all that. And then the second worst part is writing. The best part is collecting the data and doing the analysis.
Totally.
So to me, this is like nothing, you know, you never cook and you never eat, but you just do dishes, you know, the whole
thing.
And it's like, why would you do that? I mean, I'm much more likely to actually do the research and then like never write it up and definitely never turn around the response memos. And then here, and then like similarly with Bruno Frey, who legitimately did the research, but then he published the same paper four times. I'm thinking like, I don't even want to get it through peer review once. Why would you do that four times? Yeah. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, it seems like I listened to some of your previous conversations about these topics, and you know, it just struck me that there is this continuum, right? And I think you started to get at that in a previous podcast, but you know, you've got everything from complete fabrication of the data to, you know, to folks who maybe are making innocent mistakes or who are, you know, following the product of their training. And, you know, I don't know if there's an allowance in this. And it it made me think of, we talked at the beginning, well, in a joking way about, I mean, there's all this sexual harassment and there's been some discussion about, you know, the continuum there, and it gets tricky to know sort of, does anyone who does anything, do they deserve to lose their jobs? And if not, then where is that line? And
I'd say making up a bunch of data definitely falls on the side of the line where you lose your job. Although, fortunately, I think we can conclude no subjects were sexually harassed in his lab.
Yeah, I'd say, what's her name? Amy Cuddy is like an Al Franken.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that. Yeah,
yeah.
And then this guy Gagay is he's a Harvey Weinstein, but also like, what a ridiculous, if you're going to make up findings, like, why make up findings that, like, men like high heels?
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's the clickbait aspect.
Yeah, but also, that's right, because you can't exactly imagine that being, like, in the flagship journal. Because let's say it's true. Who cares? Right? What do we conclude from that? But I you're leaving out one of my favorite parts of how they caught the guy, is that there's this, one of his research methods said that, like, the research collector or data collector or whatever, the Confederate, would like basically hit on women in the street. And then after they turned them down, he'd ask them for their phone number and how old they were. And they said that like 100% of them told him how old they were. And they basically said, you know, they basically said, we're not as good looking as this research assistant, but we don't believe that women who'd just been hit on and turned down the advance would, provide that kind of personal information.
Who is this guy? I bet this guy sounds like a real trip.
Yeah.
He's your next podcast guest.
I think I'll take a hard pass on that. But
like, yeah, definitely.
But like, isn't it amazing? Like, just whatever's like all the dirty laundry's coming out everywhere, eh? Like,
yeah. I mean, no, for sure, right? But you know, I don't know that this dirty laundry, like this bit of dirty laundry being aired at this point in time, has anything to do with the whole sexual assault, harassment, and misconduct. I mean, you know what I mean? It's like, there's that, but then there's also like, I also do think that, you know, there's also this stuff that's going on in academia right now. You know, I think that there is some witch hunting going on in academia, right? Some of it is witch hunting, and some of it is, you know, is not that, and it is actually just genuine curiosity about how people get certain findings. And I don't think the two are necessarily related, but it does. I mean, it does feel like every day, like another one of our gods, right, is taken down.
Yeah, it was probably a weak tie-in. So I was looking for something, you know.
No, but it does have a connection, like Leslie was saying. There's, moral cascades of accusation, and even if this isn't meaningfully part of the, you know, Weinstein cascade of accusation, it is part of the whole replication crisis. And it's telling that this comes out of psychology, because that's the field because that's the field where people are getting increasingly skeptical of previous findings.
There's that, and a colleague of mine made a very good point, because we were having a discussion of like, when is it sociology's turn? Because there's plenty of p-hacking going on here. And
I kind of feel like those had their turn, but like in thinking about more qualitative work and thinking about ethnography, for example, I was like, who knew that the New York Times knew so much about sociology, right? For like a year.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it's also just, she made the point that those of us who are data analysts, we mostly work with secondary data.
Yeah.
Like, and really well-known set. So, if you're going to mess with GSS, you're going to get caught.
So here's why it happens with psychology and not sociology. Which, of course, I'm going to sound dumb, because in the 6 days before this comes out, there'll be a major scandal in sociology. But
totally.
Like you're just saying, right, we mostly deal with secondary data analysis. And then, as Leslie was saying, we also have original data analysis in the form of ethnography, but in neither of those cases is it amenable to someone conclusively proving you made up the data. So
right.
If somebody, whereas with psychology, they routinely collect their own data, and I can't necessarily find, you know, these guys checking out women's legs and high heels that this guy claims to have interviewed. But I could do that experiment myself easily, right? I could take a bunch of pictures that I get off Instagram and put them on MTurk, have them rated, and then I could very easily replicate his study and show whether it's true or not. And so that's how it works there. Whereas with secondary data analysis, it's like if you analyze the GSS, you'd have to be crazy to report the coefficients wrong because, you know, anybody else can download the GSS and precisely replicate your findings or not. And then with ethnography, even if you make up your field notes, you kind of have this thing of like, well, you weren't there. And with some of these accusations against ethnographers, they kind of had this, well, you weren't there, or who are you going to believe?
I can't disclose my notes or my sources.
Because there's an ethical consideration. It's a legitimate ethical consideration. But even if I did disclose my notes to you, it's going to be hard for you to verify that, you know, these things happened. One of these is probably the most high profile accusation of academic fraud with ethnography in recent years. You know, a journalist was able to verify that the field site did exist, the informants did exist, but, you know, didn't verify whether particular important instances happened. They may or may not have. And the ethnographer is like, well, you had to be there. I was there. And if you talk to these experts who say it didn't happen, well, fuck them because they just speak for power. And I'm the Lorax. I speak for the trees.
What do you have to say about this, Robert? You're an ethnographer.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, even the using ethnography, because I'm sort of trained in a qualitative method, but more the sort of interview-based research, which does involve some participant observation, ethnographic observation. But in that sense, I mean, maybe it's a middle ground. I've been thinking a lot about this, given sort of your conversations and just what's happening in the discipline and the world. But, you know, the qualitative research, I mean, it's in my vested interest to sort of think about these sorts of potential pitfalls. And, you know, we do, for those of us who do sort of interview-based work, we do have the transcripts. And, you know, there's some, you know, I don't know what the cutting edge thinking is. I know most people don't release those for the confidentiality concerns, but there might be some ways to think about how creatively, how can we, you know, release that data. I know that at Hopkins, we do a lot of team-based qualitative research. So it's not just you alone, you know, in some remote location, but, you know, if we're doing a big N interview study, then you might have, you know, dozens of people maybe from start to finish, you know, touching the data, looking at the data. And it's sort of nice for you as a researcher to be able to have other people read the transcripts and say, you know, are you seeing what I'm seeing? Because there is this subjectivity, this interpretive role that we play. And, even with my paper that we'll talk about, I mean, there's a sense of like, I mean, I know I didn't make up data. I have the transcripts, but there's still this sense of like, did I get it right? You know, did I sort of, am I seeing things the way that, and there might be more than one way to see these things. And I think that's where also we're just being transparent about your methods and your theory. And, you know, you guys have talked about that in the past a little bit too, about, I think David on a previous podcast talked about, you know, theory being one sort of key piece that differentiates qualitative sociology from, you know, journalism basically. But I also think methods is a big piece of that. I mean, we may still just talk to the same number of people in the same place, but as a sociologist, hopefully we're bringing some methodological sophistication. We know what our data does and doesn't do, what we can and can't do with this qualitative data, what claims we should and couldn't, you know, should and can and should make or shouldn't make. So, it's definitely a lot to think about. I've been thinking a lot about it, given just some of your previous conversations.
Well, I agree with all that, but I'm more impressed by the methods of journalism than I was a week ago. After seeing the Washington Post reverse sting the James O'Keefe people. They had a well-developed methodology for basically, entrapping, you know, basically, so the hunter becomes the hunted, you know, with turning around this plant.
Wow, yeah.
What, yes, that was pretty awesome. That?
Yeah. I was very angry about that, though. Imagine, like, it's such a problem for people not to believe victims as is, and for somebody to, like, try to create a high-profile event to show that, like, sexual assault accusers are liars, or you know what I mean, or discredit these women. Wow, like that takes chutzpah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and I'm like, that's when I, like, you know, not wanting to be the Cassandra again, but like that's one of the things that I'm like, oh, wait for it, wait for it.
Yeah,
yeah.
But of course, all it really did was show that the you know, WAPO really knows their shit, and you know, when the if you give it a fair-minded reading of the evidence, it shows that the accusations they publish are credible because they subject them to that level of scrutiny.
Yeah.
Well, do you think that's going to make, Robert, do you think that's going to make a difference with Trump supporters? This story, do you think it's even going to get to them?
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I don't know if, since it concerns the Washington Post, I mean, for the people I talk with, I mean, I didn't ask them about their media consumption habits, but I don't want to underplay the role of you know, O'Keefe's work or some of these, you know, far right outlets, but, and some of this, like, you know, stunt journalism or whatever you want to call it, this sort of sting stuff. But I don't know if it's actually on the radar screens of a lot of the guys that I talk to. I don't know that they're taking their cues.
Well, maybe not this specific thing, but the overall issue of his pederasty accusation has been hurting his poll numbers. And I know some of the polls have shown him competitive in what should be a slam dunk race for a Republican.
Yeah,
he has. I mean, it's a, you know, Jones might even be leading slightly. So I think there was some polling that said that this, like, 30% of respondents said they'd be more likely to support Moore. And there's a certain group of the electorate or more conspiratorial. And this is just evidence that, you know, the liberal media is out to get Moore. So you're going to have a hard time reaching them.
Well, you know, like, just one thing I have to say about that is, even if you didn't believe these women, even if you thought that this was a conspiracy fabricated, whipped up by the Washington Post, the fact that he was banned from the mall and the YMCA, right?
Wait, was that actually verified? Because I was talking to somebody who basically has my same politics, and they were saying that they, precisely because they would like to believe that Moore was banned from the mall, they were kind of skeptical of it because it seemed almost too good to be true. And they hadn't seen anything about it that wasn't like secondhand. Oh, I heard he was banned from the mall, but at least at the time they hadn't seen anything that was, oh, we had an interview with the manager of the mall. And he, you know, when there were like, you know, pictures of him in the break room saying, don't let this guy in. Or something like that.
Well, you know what? I'm going to engage in my own investigative reporting. And I will get back to you on that.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. For more information, visit theannexpodcast.com. Music is by Lena Orsa. Our production team included Anika Chowdhury and Liseth Moreno. On behalf of the Annex team, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.